It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
So we're joined here today with Mark Bray once again. I really encourage people, before you listen to this episode, if you get a chance, go back and listen to the interview we did about your book about Francisco Ferrer. There's a lot of information about kind of the background of Spanish anarchism in there that you can kind of glean from that. But just to start us off, I mean, you know, it's 2019. What is still important about speaking about the anarchist movement, the civil war in Spain, and the Spanish Revolution today?
Noam Chomsky and others, I think, have rightly argued that the Spanish Revolution and the mass collectivization of agriculture and industry that anarchists and their socialist allies carried out in parts of Spain was the most successful of example of a truly socialist revolution. If by socialist, of course, we mean the workers themselves managing and owning the means of production and not a party or a state doing it on behalf of them. And so if we're serious about making that a vision of social transformation, this is a great example. And of course, the Spanish anarchist movement of this era has been one of the most important and influential legacies for modern day anti-authoritarian resistance in Europe and beyond.
So I know we talked about this a little bit before in the last interview, but let's just talk about the roots of Spanish anarchism. How did it kind of come out of the books and pages and, you know, different speakers of the late 1800s and like develop into this mass movement? What are the roots of it?
Anarchism grew well in Spain because there were already a lot of people who were kind of anarchists already in a certain sense. So, there were a lot of what we call federal republicans. So Spain was a monarchy. Republicans are people who wanted a republican form of government instead of a monarchy. But there was a difference of opinion within the republican movement about whether to try and emulate a kind of authoritarian model, you know, kind of like the Jacobin model from the French Revolution, or a federal model that would be decentralized, that would have a lot of local autonomy. So there were a lot of federal republicans in Spain and a lot of impoverished, desperate, frustrated workers and peasants. And mid-19th century, there was no franchise. There was no voting for these people. So, you know, direct action and resistance was their survival. So in 1868, one of Bakunin's comrades goes to Spain in the context of political turmoil. The queen had just been ousted, and meets with some groups of federal republicans and similar kinds of radicals in Barcelona and Madrid. Bakunin's comrade was this guy, Giuseppe Finelli, this Italian anarchist who didn't speak Spanish or Catalan, but since he spoke Italian and that's pretty close, he could kind of, you know, communicate with people. And he brought the statutes of the First International, of Bakunin's Brotherhood. And before long, people took up the kind of Bakuninist interpretation of the First International's politics and created the Spanish section of the First International, or the Federación Regional Española. The FRE took off over the next few years with really large workers sections around the country, and was kind of an early model of what would later come to be seen as kind of anarcho-syndicalism, even if the Spanish section of the First International was not exclusively anarchist in its composition. There were people of other kinds of tendencies. And over the coming decades, there were waves of repression that the movement faced, especially into the mid-1870s, when early forms of arguments, propaganda by the deed start to develop. You start to get an emergence of a kind of an anarchist-communist politics. Debates emerge between more formal, organizationally-minded anarchists and more insurrectionary and individualist tendencies. And moving into the 20th century, after several examples of kind of different explicitly or implicitly anarchist labor federations, the CNT is formed in 1910. But really, I think the broader thing to remember about this is in the late 19th century, Spain was the peasants and workers of Spain were generally among some of the poorest of Europe. In the beginning of the 20th century, Lenin said that he thought that Spain was the country in Europe that whose conditions were most like those of Russia, considering, you know, the likelihood of a revolution. And I think he was right. And it was recognized that electoral politics, even when regular people got regular men got the vote, was a sham because they had this system where the two main parties would literally take turns in power. So anarchism was appealing in its various forms because of the lack of actual electoral participation, because of traditions of direct action, autonomy, local neighborhood, and village control. And so, you know, it just fit.
You've touched a little bit on this already, but what were the material conditions for people living in either the countryside or the industrial bases that really kind of brought them to an anti-state, anti-capitalist politic?
Well, it's important to remember that the modern state as we know it is not that old. And so if we think of a state not only as, you know, the kind of the bigger shell, but as an institution that actually affects local communities and local towns, local institutions with local police forces and so forth, that's pretty new. And so when anarchism developed in the 19th century in Spain, the modern state was sort of in the process of constructing itself and making its presence felt in people's everyday lives and in communities' everyday lives. And so the notion of kind of resisting this was something that made sense as the state as an oppressive force was enhancing its presence. Regionally, Spain is a country of regions. The different regions were different. Of course, in Andalusia in the south, that was maybe arguably in the late 19th century, the region with the strongest anarchist presence. And it was a region where the conditions of class warfare were, if not always present, always simmering beneath the surface. In 1882, there was a scandal called the Mano Negra scandal, or the Black Hand, where this alleged anarchist affinity group was accused of murder, and a bunch of anarchists were rounded up and given long prison sentences. Scholars debate whether this affinity group really existed or not, but either way, it's indicative of the kind of climate of insurrection and rebellion, and really the tradition of agrarian insurrection in the south of Spain and really throughout southern Europe and elsewhere stretched back centuries. So it wasn't something new that, you know, anarchists didn't have to tell people that when things got serious, you know, they could, you know, literally or metaphorically take the pitchfork. Industrially, Catalonia and the Basque Country were the most industrially advanced regions. And the thing is that in a lot of the rest of Europe, anarchists lost a strong influence in the labor movement in the late 19th century to a large extent compared to socialists and Marxists. But that really didn't happen in Spain. So the main socialist labor union, the UGT, which was formed in 1888 and still is a significant union in Spain today, was always much smaller than the anarchist federations of the 19th century. And even federations that popped up overnight would already, you know, immediately get 2 to 3 times the membership of the UGT, which was affiliated with the Socialist Workers' Party. So in places like Catalonia, to a lesser extent in the Basque Country, but especially in Catalonia, in Barcelona, to be a unionist often meant you joined the anti-authoritarian labor federation because they were the ones who believed that the general strike was like an important tactic, that direct action was important, that wouldn't wait around to gradually pursue the electoral route. But, you know, there was tension between the political outlook of more skilled workers, of artisans in these unions, and, landless peasants from the south of Spain who were increasingly migrating north to Catalonia as the century went along. And these tensions often played out around the relationship between insurrection and a more gradualist organizing approach within anti-authoritarian labor federations, with the landless peasants being much less, newly industrial workers, but those from southern Spain who were from that agricultural background being much less patient than skilled workers who often focused on bread and butter issues. So I mentioned before the Mano Negra scandal of 1882. What really broke the anti-authoritarian labor federation of the 1880s internally was this debate over what to do with the Mano Negra, because you have the leadership of this more skilled workforce that doesn't want to have anything to do with it, that disowns what they call criminality. And a lot of the agricultural workforce, a lot of the poorer members are more sympathetic to insurrectionary tactics and get upset with this. And they're increasingly won over by anarcho-communist ideas coming across the border from France. So, you know, it's different regionally, and it's interesting how these kinds of class backgrounds play out in different political outlooks.
Yeah, and we'll kind of speak to that as we go on. Well, I'm just curious, you know, you brought up all these different tendencies and people from different areas kind of having different ideas in terms of tactics. So going into when the CNT was created, how did that history influence that? I mean, was it kind of a reaction to what had come before, or were these tensions still kind of playing out in the background? Because from our understanding, it's that anarchists made a decisive decision to basically really engage with the CNT and make sure that its politics were largely anarchist.
A lot of, I think, like academics make too much out of some of these differences and tendencies, especially in this late 19th, early 20th century context. Even the quote-unquote individualists or the insurrectionaries were often also would here and there participate in labor federations. And, you know, a lot of the unionists would participate in plots to assassinate the king or what have you. So, you know, the milieu was sort of flexible and people would kind of, you know, migrate here and there. But yes, these tensions between, if you want to speak in sort of loose general terms, between insurrectionary and more gradualist approaches within anarchist unionism caused tensions in earlier federations and would emerge with the CNT as well. The CNT was formed in 1910. It grew out of a previous anti-authoritarian revolutionary syndicalist labor federation called Solidaridad Obrera, or Workers' Solidarity, which existed at the tail end of the first decade of the 20th century and was involved in a kind of legendary insurrection called the Tragic Week of 1909 in Barcelona, which was a kind of anti-clerical uprising against conscription for a colonial war in Morocco. And Solidaridad Obrera organized a general strike that became a kind of revolutionary general strike. But, you know, ideas for, and Solidaridad Obrera was a regional federation in Catalonia. So the idea for expanding it to the entire country was something that had been kicked around earlier. Some of the earlier federations were throughout Spain. And in 1910, the CNT was formed, and it was basically made illegal shortly thereafter because there was so much enthusiasm for workers striking and pushing revolutionary goals that they sometimes even pushed the CNT and leadership farther than they were interested in moving. And of course, by leadership, I mean not in the sense of, you know, a vanguard party, but those who had official positions that, you know, that had been delegated by the federation. So the CNT was made illegal for a couple of years in the beginning of the 19-teens, came back, and its membership increased over the course of the decade and peaked somewhere around 800,000 members by the end of the decade, like 1919. And that would actually be it's the peak membership of the CNT before the Civil War. It participated in an important strike around then that led Spain to adopt the 8-hour day, the first country, and you did so in response to a massive anarchist general strike. So if you want to think about how to improve conditions of workers, even through legislation, that's a good model of how to get things done. In 1923, Spain had a dictatorship. So a lot of people know about Franco taking over after the Spanish Civil War, but fewer people know about the Primo de Rivera dictatorship, which lasted from 1923 to 1930. And during this time, the CNT was made illegal, and there were debates within the CNT about whether to try and find some accommodation with the state to continue to organize legally. That was the sort of more bread and butter syndicalist line, and whether to go underground and organize, an insurrectionary strategy to topple the regime. And so there were figures on both sides of that and plenty of people in the middle. And during this time, you know, some anarchists affiliated or unaffiliated with the CNT carry out different kinds of, you know, bank robberies and so forth. But this is also a tension that would reemerge when the First Republic was proclaimed in 1931. The Second Republic. The First Republic existed very briefly in 1873, very unsuccessful, but the Second Republic was proclaimed in 1931, and it was an interesting situation for anarchists because Spain had had a monarchy since the fall of the First Republic in 1873, so for decades, the anarchist movement had struggled under the dictatorship of Primo de Rivera, and, oh, I forgot to mention that the formation of the Iberian Anarchist Federation, or in Spanish is often referred to as the FAI, FAI, in 1927 was in part in response to these debates within the movement about how to respond to the dictatorship and kind of a legalist bread and butter syndicalist line within the CNT that anarchists were concerned would take it away from its revolutionary goals. So, anyway, 1931, the Republic is proclaimed, and actually many anarchists and many in the CNT were very enthusiastic about this. But quickly, being against the state, as anarchists are, started to organize strike waves against this new Republic that led to very severe repression. So it was very clear shortly thereafter that the Second Republic was not really going to be the friend to the workers, and that in many ways they were even more repressive than some right-wing regimes. And so these debates emerged again. You have figures like Garcia Oliver, Durruti, and so forth, who push a kind of insurrectionary, even a kind of illegalist strategy in 1932, 1933. This is the era of what's called the Tres Ochos, or the Three Eights, which were a series of really very unsuccessful anarchist insurrections on the 8th of the month in January of 32. I think it was January of 33 and November of 33. They all fail. And this kind of strategy of insurrection, bank robberies, setting bombs near police stations and so forth, alienates a lot of the more moderate membership of the CNT, and its membership ranks decline. And moving closer to 1936, when the Civil War starts, there's a bit of a shift back to a more union-focused strategy within the CNT leading up to the war. So those scholars who sort of blame the CNT specifically for the war happening miss the degree to which the CNT was actually taking steps away from that insurrectionary strategy as 36 came along. And even some figures like Durruti and others said that they had been hadn't been as successful as they hoped it had been. So those debates existed. There was a faction that issued what they called the Manifesto of the 30, They were expelled from the CNT, and Angel Pestaña, one of the CNT leaders, formed the Syndicalist Party, so it shows just how far they go from anarchism. But those debates, I think, are kind of inherent to some extent in any kind of mass anarcho-syndicalist formation. That tension, I think, can never be entirely surpassed, and I think at its best maybe could be a useful tension, but anyway, that's another conversation.
Well, just real quick before we kind of jump back into the timeline, you know, so I mean, there's close to almost a million members of the CNT. You said its height. I mean, there's all these people in the countryside that are getting involved in anarchist politics. I mean, if you could just describe kind of like the rank and file CNT or just member or somebody involved in kind of like these formations. I mean, is this somebody that's like reading anarchist papers all the time? Or are they going to meetings? I mean, with the amount of people.
Yeah, the everyday. Sure. By the 30s, there was a robust, long-lasting anarchist, anti-authoritarian tradition in Spain where there were families, where the parents had been anarchists, where the grandparents had been anarchists, where children were raised believing some of the core tenets of Spanish anti-authoritarian thought, you know, anti-clericalism, anti-state perspectives, anti-capitalism. There was a kind of anarchist educational tradition. As you mentioned earlier, I did a book about the modern school in Francisco Ferrer. Ateneos were very important. Ateneos were essentially kind of cultural intellectual centers where they weren't exclusively anarchists. They were Ateneos of all different kinds of stripes, but there were plenty of anarchist or kind of free thinking, as they called it, Ateneos, where speakers would give lectures for audiences, not only on explicitly anarchist topics, but also on, you know, the latest developments in science or politics around the world for people who wanted to be educated, because illiteracy was super high. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the majority of people in the CNT would have been illiterate. But, you know, there was a kind of thirst for knowledge. The anarchist press was robust and important. Of course, it always went through waves of repression and being, you know, taken out of circulation by the authorities or fined. Anarchist publishers always got a lot of fines or prison sentences for what they published. There was not much leeway in that regard. But the newspapers would often be read to groups. Well, one interesting manifestation of that some listeners will be familiar with would be in the cigar factories in Cuba and in Florida, where during this period there would be a reader who would sit in front of the workers and read while they worked. And of course, anarchists would always try to get that job to read anarchist newspapers or books. So, you know, papers would be shared. They'd be read aloud to people who couldn't read them. People would attend Ateneos educational events. There were also different kinds of clubs. Some anarchists were interested in vegetarianism, nudism. I came across an interesting report from an undercover police infiltrator into an anarchist group in the 1890s who explained his horror at having to get naked on the beach with the anarchists in order not to blow his cover. There were also
there's one way to make sure somebody's not wearing a wire.
Yeah, well, there's that. And, you know, there were plenty of different publishers. And, you know, there was a kind of a robust culture. The anarchists would sometimes run bars or restaurants. So there were a few, you know, known anarchist hangout spots in Barcelona. And, you know, in cities in Spain and elsewhere, that's still true today. So, you know, but the thing is that most people in the CNT were not, you know, anarchist ideologues. They were people who recognized that the government wasn't actually interested in representing them, that direct action was an effective form of resistance, that, you know, their experience with Catholic education was horrible and they didn't like the church, you know. So, and I think that's true of politics in general, is that most people are not ideologues. Most people respond to their circumstances. their social and material realities and what kinds of politics make sense with what they've been taught, with what they learn. A great example of that was, I have a short little story. I was in a library in Barcelona in 2010, and I was looking at a book about the Juventudes Libertarias, or the Libertarian Youth, which was the anarchist youth group during the era. And this older man stops by and says, "Hey, I was a part of that." And I was like, "Okay, don't go anywhere. Talk to me." And he, you know, he was like 18 in 1936 or something like that. And he said he participated in the Libertarian Youth primarily because they threw really good parties. You know, so that's a, you know, part of politics that shouldn't be ignored, that, yes, he took out of his experience some sort of basic anti-authoritarian principles. But, you know, a lot of people gravitated to it because that's sort of where the life of the community was headed.
I think that's kind of really what's interesting is that, I mean, like in the United States today, it seems like the parallel would be not something political, but say like church functions or something, like something that just kind of brings people together, that kind of creates these core values. And also too, just, it's almost like strange to think of like so many people kind of like having kind of like a gut association with the idea that, like, you know, we can directly do something, like, in a, you know, basically impose our will on everything else, as opposed to just kind of like passively being like, yeah, things suck, you know.
Yeah, and really a lot of this history is the CNT or anarchist organizations really playing catch up. A lot of the Wren strikes, or a lot of the kind of riots that consumers organized against high prices, often led by women, were you know, more or less kind of spontaneous situations that CNT militants sort of followed along and lent their organizational support to. And part of the reason why this culture developed is my advisor in grad school, Temma Kaplan, wrote this great book called Red City Blue Period about art, aesthetics, and revolution in Barcelona during this era. And one of the things that she emphasizes is that, you know, the politics flourished in part because there was a thriving culture of people doing things outside in large groups around festivals and processions and parties. And even the kind of geography of some of these main cities in Spain, with these big plazas and spaces that lend themselves towards congregation, lent themselves to this kind of activity in a way that, you know, today a lot of places where Americans live have been designed to really make that very hard to do.
Well, just to kind of jump back into the timeline, you kind of brought this up, but let's talk about the tension with electoralism in the CNT. You mentioned there was kind of like a small strand within it that, like, at one point wanted to, like, enter politics. I think this is interesting because a similar thing kind of happened with the IWW. I mean, ultimately, that strain, you know, obviously didn't win. But also, you know, the CNT at certain times, like, did advocate people voting to, like, get political prisoners out of prison. I'm just curious if you can just kind of talk about that.
Well, the CNT, to my knowledge, never told people to vote. It sometimes did not tell people not to vote, which may sound like a game of semantics, but I think is a bit different. You know, The generic, of course, would be to organize what Spanish anarchists often refer to as a kind of campaign of active abstention. But there were some notable periods in the early 30s during the Second Republic when there were so many people in prison that, like when the Popular Front was on the ballot, the CNT did not organize a campaign of active abstention. Individual figures, you know, advocated what they advocated. Beyond that, in terms of the kind of relationship to electoral politics, Spain had a different history than the United States with, you know, quote unquote, democracy. And so the faction that became the syndicalist party from the CNT was not very big. Although the CNT did have kind of at times during this period fraternal relationships with some of the left Catalan parties, there were plenty of efforts in the 19-teens to try and organize jointly with the socialist UGT, not on electoral lines, but on common union lines, even though the UGT was affiliated with the Socialist Party. But, you know, in general, the stronger debates were less about what to do vis-a-vis voting and more about how much should the union focus on organizing and building its strength versus how much should it organize on sparking the revolution now? And I think that's kind of an interesting philosophical question for anarcho-syndicalists when you have a big movement. Of course, when you don't, that's not relevant. But when you do have a big movement, when is it the right time to say, okay, the purpose that for which we've been building this union, which is at least avowedly to launch a revolutionary general strike and spark the social revolution. Like, are we there yet? And if not, how close do we need to be? And that was sort of the main issue that would pop up here. And then when, of course, the war started, when the nationalists rose up, that became kind of moot because the moment sort of presented itself.
Right. And we're going to get into that in just a second. But one last kind of like pre-Civil War revolution question is, you brought up the FAI. Let's just talk about them for a bit and just talk about that kind of interplay between the two groups, or was there a division, and just kind of like how did that play out with the CNT existing alongside the FAI?
Yeah, well, the FAIG has been given a reputation as being by sort of critics as being the kind of most zealous fanatical militants within the milieu, but really it was much more diverse and pluralistic. For example, a lot of the most ardent anarchists involved in educational initiatives in the early and mid 30s were faistas, as they called them. And really the kind of premise behind the creation of the FAI was to create a kind of anarchist political organization that to some extent is part of the longer tradition that Bakunin and Nestor Makhno and other similar figures promoted about working within mass movements as anarchists, because, you know, there was the debate in 1907 between Malatesta and some syndicalists about whether or not revolutionary syndicalism made sense if you create these high ideological barriers for people to enter. In other words, if you're trying to organize everyday people, do you require them to be anarchists before they join? Malatesta's argument was, if they're already anarchists, let's just have the revolution. Why bother? And if they're not, then how are you going to organize them into a union that has these high barriers of entry? He didn't see the degree to which the CNT would largely accomplish something along those lines. But the role of the FI was to maintain that presence, push back against, for example, those within the union who well, this is before the FI, but that wanted to join the Communist Third International, or wanted to create a political party, or were against launching a social revolution because they just wanted to pursue incremental labor organizing. But, you know, in general, it was a broader kind of formation. And you know, there were sort of tensions between these different factions, but I think the FI simply sort of institutionalized dynamics that had already existed.
Let's now turn towards, you know, the breakout of the Spanish Civil War and the start of the Spanish Revolution. And I think, you know, one interesting question, you know, obviously the first time that you came on the program was to talk about your book on anti-fascism. And, you know, the Civil War began with a coup, with people backing, General Franco, who himself was backed by the Nazis and, you know, the fascist powers. So talk about the breakout of the Civil War, but also just how did the Spanish anarchist movement look at the rise of fascism? You know, what was their take on it, and kind of like, what were they thinking about when this coup actually did finally break out?
Well, certainly, you know, they were concerned about the rise of fascism, and the anarchist movement, and really the left in general, was very aware of the likelihood of a right-wing coup against the Spanish Republic in response to the electoral victory of the Popular Front in 1936. So the CNT was making preparations. They were stockpiling weapons. They knew that this was coming. And there were even requests made by some left factions to the government to arm them in advance. The government didn't do that. And so in response to the kind of question of anti-fascism, it became increasingly tied up into the question of what to do with other left or loyalist factions, loyal meaning loyal to the Republic, and the debates about the government, right? So when the right-wing soldiers rose up in Barcelona on July 19th of 1936, the workers' militias, primarily the CNT, but also their allies, put down the uprising, and were, the CNT was pretty much as Orwell describes in his Homage to Catalonia, were the masters of the situation, and they had a choice about what to do. Figures like Garcia Oliver especially argued that anarchists should just take control of areas that they controlled. But the majority opinion was to try and find some way of coexistence with the other left factions, primarily socialists and left Catalanist factions. And so the Generalitat, which was the Catalan government, the anarchists essentially allowed it to reestablish itself with anarchist participation in it. And the argument was, in a certain sense, a kind of pragmatic, you could say, anti-fascist argument about pooling forces, pushing in the same direction to pursue the defeat of the common enemy. Now, obviously, there are a lot of legitimate critiques to be made of that decision and of the later decision to join the central government that the CNT made, with figures like Federica Montseny becoming government ministers. Incidentally, I believe that the CNT leader, Federica Montseny, was the first woman to be a government minister in European history, a kind of ironic, tragic tidbit. But there are a lot of critiques to be made of all these things. But I think that we should all bear in mind that the anarchist movement was sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place and didn't really have very good options, because obviously, as it turned out, these decisions were terrible decisions. Maybe we'll get into it more detail soon, but to fast forward, they are stabbed in the back by Stalinists and the anarchist movement is destroyed. On the other hand, if they had just chose to go it alone, that wouldn't have worked either. So I think that it's unfortunately a kind of tragic situation where, barring major changes in the geopolitical situation, there was not a really happy ending to this story. So that has sort of colored interpretations of anti-fascism, that betrayal on the part of the Soviet-backed forces. But maybe you want to get into that through a different angle.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I remember there's one classic story. I think it was like the governor of Barcelona or something like that coming to the CNT and just said, like, you know, I'm ready to give up my title and join the militias. And the CNT was basically like, no, you should basically stay where you are. Like, let's keep the government structure. Like,
yeah, they balked. And that's the thing that I suggest people check out, Chris Elam's book, Anarchism in the City, on AK Press. It's a really fantastic recounting of all this information. And the point that he makes, which I think is one of the best points to be made, is that the CNT did not really create an alternative body to invest sovereignty into in the context of Barcelona and Catalonia. You know, at the time, they allowed the Generalitat to come back almost because they didn't have something better to put forward. And they, you know, they had neighborhood patrols and they had the collectives and so forth, but there was a vacuum there that they did not fill. And then, of course, over time, the Generalitat and other forces gradually ate away the kind of path that the CNT and the anarchist movement had established. That's essentially what happened.
You know, we'll come back to that, kind of that tension. And also just, you know, the other side was that people kind of like associated with Durruti were making the argument that the war and the revolution are the same, against involvement in the state and all that. But let's talk about, you know, some of the good stuff, just in terms of the revolution. let's just talk about kind of the extent of it and just how far it went, both in terms of, you know, social relations, whether in the countryside, it was people like literally abolishing money in some areas, people collectivizing industry, just in terms of just looking at it, kind of like taking a step back from a historical stance, you know, what did the revolution achieve?
Right. So in Catalonia and Valencia and Aragon, in basically, if you're looking at a map of Spain, the kind of northeast area of the country, there was widespread rural control of the land, workers' control of industry. So starting out with agriculture, there were a wide variety of different kinds of schemes that people took up. So there was no one model, which of course figures the kind of notion of anti-authoritarian revolution, but in different areas, the land was collectivized and worked in common. In others, large estates were divided up and given to people, and those who chose to group them could group them. As you mentioned, some collectives abolished money entirely. Others created different kinds of vouchers. You know, the way that people were remunerated for their own labor varied. In some cases, all workers were given the same wage. In others, there was a kind of family wage that attempted to take into account whether someone who was working had people that they had to care for, children or what have you. So there was a wide variety of schemes. I recommend people checking out books by Sam Dolgoff, Gaston Laval, in Martha Acklesberg's book on the Mujeres Libres, the Free Women of Spain. She talks about different arrangements. There's a bunch of books out there that get into the real nitty-gritty of how this was done. But, you know, it was all a product of generations of political education and grew out of the kind of lived everyday experiences of farmers, agricultural workers who recognized that there was a better way of doing things. And there were, you know, committees set up to redistribute some of the agricultural produce to different areas that needed it more. In the city, a lot of buildings were, you know, state buildings or large capitalist buildings were taken over in Barcelona. I believe, if I remember correctly, it was like the Employers Federation was taken over and made into the Casa Sanitaria, the CNT house. A lot of the streets were renamed after revolutionary figures like Marx or Derrida, or even literary figures like Dostoevsky, Francisco Ferrer, even Mateo Moral, the anarchist who tried to blow up the king in 1906, had a few streets named after him. Churches were often repurposed. So sometimes through like local assemblies deciding what to do with them, whether to use them as like, you know, hospitals, meeting places, or even stables for horses. But they, you know, for the most part, at least in Barcelona, they were repurposed and not completely destroyed. Some prisons were destroyed, though. There was a women's prison in the Raval neighborhood of Barcelona that was the Mujeres Libres, I believe it was, played a key role in deciding to blow it up. So that's pretty great. And industry was collectivized. I think in general there was generally more success with agricultural collectivization than industrial, but nevertheless the industrial collectivization was largely successful. Most former managers or capitalist type folks were invited to simply participate as equal workers in a lot of the arrangements. And of course, that led to the kind of situation that Orwell describes in Homage to Catalonia, where initially he's there, everyone's wearing working class garb, rather than referring to each other with the formal usted, everyone refers to each other as tú, with salute, with a different kind of language of the working class revolution. But he comes back something like 6 months later and the vibes change because, you know, to some extent, there was a degree to which the potential for the counter-revolution was lurking beneath the surface. Nevertheless, you know, it was really inspiring examples of widespread workers' control of industry and really the kind of abolition of homelessness and hunger, because people were pretty much taken off the streets, were given places to stay, were given places to participate in the production of the war effort. But it was hard because, you know, there was a real scarcity of resources, of materials, because, you know, this is the sort of larger political situation, but the United Kingdom, France, the United States did not help the Spanish Republic. The only immediate aid the Spanish Republic gained was from Mexico, and then shortly thereafter, begrudgingly, from the Soviet Union. So, you know, there were a lot of challenges involved, but nevertheless, a really inspiring model for how workers can take it back.
Now, you brought up a couple groups I want to talk about, but you brought up the Mujeres Libres and also the Libertarian Youth. I'm curious, you know, during the revolution, what role did these groups play? What all were they doing, like, in the breakout of the revolution to kind of put those things in motion?
The Libertarian Youth, the Juventudes Libertarias, are kind of interesting because it didn't have a purely age connotation. Like, there were guys in their 30s who were part of the Libertarian Youth, which would, you know, strike us as strange. But it was often kind of associated with a kind of youthful revolutionary character. But nevertheless, like, you know, when we talk about the Spanish Revolution, the CNT, of course, is the driving force of the anti-authoritarian movement, but it's broader than that. It also included the Juventudes Libertarias, the Mujeres Libres, the FAI, and other kinds of, you know, collectives and groups. The Mujeres Libres formed right around this time and were not, for the most part, given a lot of respect by a lot of the men within the CNT. There was still, of course there still is today, lingering patriarchal tendencies within the movement. There were, you know, interesting debates about what to do with sex work at the time, where initially, I believe there were some efforts to organize sex workers in Barcelona, but generally speaking, the Mujeres Libres focused on more of a perspective of abolishing, you know, what's often referred to as prostitution, and trying to kind of re-educate these women, quote unquote, and bring them into different lines of work. Broadly speaking, the kind of gender politics of the Mujeres Libres and the anarchist movement of the time was largely kind of an essentialist first wave perspective, though there were debates about whether or not to view gender as a social construct or to view women as kind of biologically different but equally deserving of respect in a kind of reciprocal, holistic movement or society. But, you know, they published a periodical. They played an important role in pushing back against patriarchal tendencies within the CNT. And, you know, the anarchist movement as a whole had this kind of broader intellectual political climate. Initially, the anarchist movement tried to not send teenagers, young people out to fight in the war based on the notion that they believed that it was important to leave the young generation unscarred by the war so that they wouldn't, you know, be kind of messed up by all of the kind of baggage that violence brings after the revolution. But as things got more desperate, they, you know, brought all hands on deck.
You know, if anybody's ever had the experience of being an anarchist, maybe at like a big demonstration and like some communist party person with some like Leninist sect will come up to you, I think one of the first things they say is that the reason that a, you know, quote unquote revolutionary state needs to exist is because you need basically a vanguard party or some sort of state force to deal with the counter revolution. And I'm curious, you know, you brought up people fighting in the war, the militias against Franco. How did the anarchists do in terms of, you know, waging essentially anti-authoritarian warfare against these people that were rising up that were also backed by the Nazis and fascist Italy?
Well, I mean, the Republican forces as a whole generally did pretty awfully, whether they were anarchists or not. Throughout the course of the war, I think that if I remember correctly, there were only really two decisive Republican military victories. The most famous probably being the Battle of Guadalajara, when you had the Garibaldi brigades, the Italian international fighters defeating and their anarchists and other allies defeating Mussolini's well-equipped forces that got stuck in the mud during the snow. But generally speaking, they were up against, you know, Hitler's forces, Mussolini's forces. They were against Franco, and the nationalist forces as a whole had the entire Spanish army, give or take, on their side, whereas the Republican forces, I think, you know, some, most of the Air Force remained loyal, but for the most part, the armed forces were on the other side. People experienced in fighting, supported by Hitler and Mussolini. And the thing is that the non-intervention agreement that was reached through the League of Nations was respected by the powers that would have potentially been sympathetic to the Republic, but was ignored, with the exception of the Soviet Union, I suppose, but what was ignored by Hitler and Mussolini. So the Republican military forces were ill-equipped, you know, some soldiers not having adequate clothing or even weapons. In terms of the question of, like, specifically anarchist formations where they would, you know, democratically decide who their commander would be, I'm not a military historian and I don't know the nitty gritty of this, but they seem to have done, give or take, as well as the other kinds of militia formations that developed. I mean, the broader issue when you're having the conversation with, you know, authoritarian Marxists about the thing is that if your sole goal is organizing a group of people to kill another group of people, hierarchy is generally better. Like that, I wouldn't dispute. But what happens in the process is that goal of kind of violent militaristic efficiency starts to win out over all other considerations, and you get authoritarian regimes that, you know, commit genocides and murder millions of people. So, you know, I think that's the other side that always needs to be brought into the conversation. But I don't think that it's inherently impossible to organize militarily or to organize against a counter-revolution without some sort of very stratified hierarchical apparatus. The fact of the matter is that, you know, even when the anarchist militias were incorporated into the hierarchical structure dictated by Moscow through their support for the Republic, and the militias were largely broken up. There were exceptions like the Iron Column that refused to be incorporated. But even when the anarchist militias were incorporated and given a hierarchical structure, it didn't actually result in different battlefield results. So in that context, I think that that's kind of missing the larger point of resources, equipment, and experience.
Well, let's talk about the role of Derudi and also the group. The Friends of Derudi, after he was killed, became important as well. You know, during the revolution itself, what role did he play, and kind of like what was his position within all the things we've been talking about?
Yeah, he led a big column of militia, 3,000 anarchist fighters, I think, give or take, from Barcelona down to defend Madrid. And Madrid became the focal point for much of the war because, you know, I think people, when they think of civil wars, imagine something akin to the American Civil War, where you have different regions that have different loyalties to one side or the other. But what happened with the Spanish Civil War was there was a coordinated series of military risings in different parts of the country, and the nationalists ended up controlling those areas where those military risings were successful and didn't where they were unsuccessful. So you have a kind of hodgepodge where, you know, the nationalists end up initially controlling Andalusia in the south, Extremadura in the west. They control much of northern Spain, with the exception of much of the Basque country. And there's kind of a semicircle around Madrid where Franco's forces make a push to occupy Madrid, because if you control the capital, you can get all the international powers to recognize your legitimacy, and you can kind of wrap up the war that way. So there was a strong push on Madrid, and so the defense of Madrid became the defense of the Republic, and forces from the eastern part of the country were sent to reinforce it. Derudi's column was one of those militia forces. He was killed about a week after he arrived. He was shot in the back, and the kind of circumstances of his death are still a mystery to this day. Was he killed by some sort of fascist infiltrator? Was there some sort of personal dispute between someone else? We don't know. But there's a video, I think you can see it on YouTube, of his funeral when he's brought back to Barcelona, and there's just, you know, what looks like hundreds of thousands, million people in the streets honoring him as he's brought back. He became, you know, the kind of legend. And also, since he died so early, and since he didn't join what would later be the kind of central government in Madrid, he sort of came to embody the best early days of the social revolution. And he was kind of gone by the time some of the internal conflict, some of the debate, some of the doubt emerged. And so in that way, you mentioned the group Friends of Derudi, that issued a proclamation critiquing the entrance into the central government. And in that way, they could use him as a kind of symbol of that. But, you know, early on, when he marched to Madrid, he did it in support of a kind of joint coalition anti-fascist effort to fight back against Franco. And he died before it was time to kind of get into some of these much more contentious issues. And that way he could be taken up. And, you know, he had developed a reputation as a kind of, you know, almost superhero anarchist bank robber figure. He spent time in Argentina doing that. He kind of blended some of the elements of kind of illegalist anarchist politics, insurrectionary politics, but was also in the CNT very firmly supportive of anarcho-syndicalism and building working class power. So he sort of cut across a lot of these lines that are assumed to be mutually exclusive to kind of embody this revolutionary ethos. And then, you know, his image was taken on and carried forward. And from what I've been told by some people in Spain today, his legacy has sort of been strangely whitewashed to be representative of kind of this anti-fascist military figure who defended the Republic, with less of a focus on him being an anarchist within Spain in the kind of textbooks that kids learn about, which I find very strange.
Yeah, just on a tangent, I'm curious, you know, it sounds like you've gone to Spain and done some research. I mean, how is the Spanish Revolution talked about in Spain, you know, are the anarchists kind of viewed as kind of like hopeless revolutionaries or like crazy bomb throwers? Or I'm just kind of curious, like, how the everyday culture kind of looks back on that period, because, you know, growing up in the United States, you know, there might be like three sentences of like, oh yeah, there was a civil war in Spain leading up to World War II, and that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, and as a professor that often teaches surveys on European history, it's amazing how many modern European history classes just skip over the Spanish Civil War. But, you know, obviously during the Franco era, the take on it was the Franquista argument about a kind of war against the emissaries of Satan, the Reds, et cetera, et cetera. But after that, speaking to people that, I don't know, maybe are in their 20s or 30s or 40s, and grew up in Spain, the impression that I get, you know, sort of anecdotally, is that there was a strong focus on kind of forgetting and moving on, which I think reflected the degree to which the transition towards quote unquote democracy in the late 70s after Franco died in 75 was not accompanied by a kind of truth and reconciliation committee that you got after dictatorships in Argentina and other places, but was just sort of a product of an agreement to try and ignore what happened and move on while still allowing a lot of the kind of vestiges of Franquismo to persist. So people tell me they aren't really taught a lot in school about the Spanish Revolution. And in that way, the people that I met who know about it sort of learned about it either through family or through kind of researching it on their own later in life.
Let's talk about, you know, we brought this up earlier, but the betrayal of, you know, the Stalinist elements and of the Communist Party with the anarchists, and also just, you know, towards the end, you know, the anarchists or some, you know, very few anarchists making the decision to join the formal government. I mean, ironically, even some of the people from the FI ended up as government ministers. And I'm just kind of curious if you can just talk about those two elements and kind of how that led to the end of the Civil War, which of course ended in Franco's forces winning.
Sure. Well, the Spanish Communist Party before the war was super tiny and politically irrelevant. But over the years during the Second Republic, the profile of the Spanish Communist Party and the role of the Soviet Union in what is increasingly imagined as a kind of global struggle against fascism starts to increase. And then, you know, when the time comes for international intervention, the Soviet Union is really the only major power that is willing to support the Republic. And so they get a lot of prestige through doing that. And they don't do it. They don't give a blank check to the Spanish Republic. So they're willing to provide weapons and ammunition and so forth, but they demand a very steep price for it. And the weapons that they send are essentially the kind of crappy old weapons that they don't want to use. Because remember, this is a context where Stalin is anticipating, and rightly so, is anticipating having to fight a war against the Nazis soon. I think it was 1928 or so, he gives this now famous speech where he says, in 10 years, we need to make this country industrialized and ready to wage a war in 10 years, which is more or less the kind of timeline of how it turns out to be. And so his focus in everything is how to make the Soviet Union as strong and able to defend itself as possible. So he views the Spanish Civil War not as kind of a romantic, quote-unquote, opportunity to support comrades, but as an opportunity to bolster the position of the Soviet Union in a couple of ways. One is to make a lot of money. So a lot of the gold reserves of the Second Republic are sent over. And if you are not believing that as true or want information on that, there's a great book called Spain Betrayed, which it delved into these Soviet archival documents to hash all this out. And politically, the Soviet Union sends over different kinds of commissars and basically forces the anti-fascist forces to adopt a kind of hierarchical military model with directives from Moscow, and to sort of essentially kind of take over the government. So I'm talking through this, of course, in a very loose way because we don't have time to get into all the particularities. But in short, by virtue of being the dominant power, the Soviet Union gets its way, and the prestige of the Communist Party, and in Catalonia there was a called the PSUC, was the Unified Communist Party with some other forces, become a dominant force. And so in this way, the benefit of the Spanish Civil War for Stalin is it redirects all of the military forces of Europe in the other direction. Hitler and Mussolini are busy going the other way, and he's really just hoping that it lasts as long as possible to buy him more time to industrialize, to prepare the Red Army for a war, and to increasingly purge the quote-unquote traitors within the ranks, because this is the context of the famous show trials where all these different commanders and leaders are sent to the gulag, some of which, from an anarchist perspective, ironically, were some of the main military figures who put down the Kronstadt uprising 15 years early, so earlier, so you know that kind of came around to bite them. But so that's the kind of context that this happens. They organize the international brigades. Thousands of fighters come from around the world, many of them communist affiliated, but some of them not, or some of them just being general leftists who want an opportunity to fight. And a very significant number of those international brigades fighters died in combat. They were sometimes put, you know, right at the front of battle and suffered heavy losses. Probably most strongly represented in terms of national groups were, of course, predictably Germans and Italians, who weren't that far away and who wanted an opportunity to fight back against Hitler and Franco somewhere else. And so over time, you know, the Soviet mandates about organization, and also their mandates about politics are very important too. So the CNT and many of their socialist allies are pushing for a social revolution in the countryside and in industry. And they argue, as I think you mentioned earlier, that the social revolution and the war are inseparable. The Stalinist forces come on the scene to argue the opposite, that revolution should wait. It's time to unify against the fascist forces. So this kind of popular front politics of joining hand in hand with the capitalist class, with the bourgeoisie, to fight. So the Communist Party grows, but its growth is not at the expense of the other socialist and anarchist forces. It's largely its ranks are being swelled by shopkeepers, employers who ironically like the Stalinist defense of capitalist property, because remember the sort of geostrategic vision during this time has shifted away from the early Comintern focus on fomenting revolution abroad towards building up, bourgeois parliamentary governments that could form a bulwark against Hitler, Mussolini, and trade with the Soviet Union. So they're not interested in social revolution, let alone a social revolution that would be, from their vantage point, anarchist or Trotskyist. So their agents over time build these like secret prisons. They capture Trotskyist and anarchist leaders, have them tortured. And so going back to Homage to Catalonia, when Orwell flees Barcelona towards the end of the book, he's not actually fleeing Franco. He's fleeing the Stalinist agents. The most famous kind of manifestation of these tensions is known as the May Days in May of 1937, when the Stalinist forces, the PSUC, in league with the police who've been reestablished at the expense of local neighborhood militia patrols, stormed the telephone exchange, which had been operated by the CNT. And several days of street fighting emerged between, on the one side, the CNT and the PUM, which George Orwell was fighting in at the time, and the Stalinist forces and the police on the other side. As things heated up, the national CNT leadership told their rank and file members not to fight back, to lay down their weapons because they didn't want a sort of civil war within the civil war. And, you know, the thing is that the civil war lasted from 1936 to 1939. But from an anarchist perspective, certainly by the May Days moving into mid-1937, the vast majority of what they were fighting for had already been sort of eaten away from within.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, we could spend another podcast talking about that period. Also, you know, the guerrilla war that was waged by a lot of anarchists during the Franco period. And then, of course, you know, what happened after Franco died and, you know, the CNT was allowed to come back. But, you know, before we kind of get into just wrapping it up, I just wanted to ask real quick, can you speak at all to people from America? I know that there were like Wobblies, for instance, an anarchist that went from America to fight in Spain. Do we know anything about them?
Yeah.
Who they were?
Yeah, there's plenty about the Abraham Lincoln brigades, of the international brigades. A lot of Americans went over of a variety of different political stripes. I think actually a significant number of them were New York City school teachers. And when a lot of them came back, those that survived, they were frequently blacklisted and found it very hard to get jobs. So, you know, if we think about mainstream villainization of anti-fascists today, it was actually probably a fair amount worse back then. Wow. And this is, of course, leading into the McCarthy era and so forth. And of course, the international brigades were called the quote unquote premature fascists, which is a silly designation, but gets across how people viewed them prior to the quote unquote official anti-fascist conflict of World War II. But there were anarchists and anti-authoritarians who went over and found the CNT and fought with them. I don't personally know a ton about those figures, but I know that there's documentation about it, and that, you know, a lot of French anarchists crossed the border and fought with the CNT. But because of its kind of international organizational apparatus, the Comintern and the international brigades kind of dominated that aspect of it.
Yeah, and also Emma Goldman famously visited Spain and worked with the CNT too.
Yeah, and helped to publicize the effort abroad. Anatole Dolgoff, Sam Dolgoff's son, wrote a neat book for AK Press called Left of Left, where he talks about how his father, Sam, you know, didn't have very good vision, wasn't sort of physically up to necessarily going over and fighting, but instead of doing that, spent every waking hour in the U.S., you know, supporting the war effort, raising money and so forth. And that was part of the story as well.
You know, today there's a lot of parallels. I mean, obviously there's, you know, growing fascism around the world, as we've talked about before. There's kind of this lingering question for anarchists of left unity, how to interact with other formations. I'm just curious, you know, in your mind, looking back at this history, what are the big takeaways for anarchists today that the Spanish Revolution and the Spanish Civil War can teach us?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because in doing my research for my Antifa book, I spoke to anarcho-syndicalist comrades in Spain and France, some of whom were very dismissive of the notion of anti-fascism at all, as like a kind of as a pan-radical left notion of resistance. And one even said, well, you know, the way that you stop fascism is you make the social revolution, which, of course, if we could, we would. But, you know, that's not always immediately plausible. But that raises the important point that most of the history of anarchists, joining sides with authoritarian comrades has ended very poorly, whether you're looking at the situation during the Russian Revolution or the Spanish Civil War. And you know, that's not an accident, because the kind of Marxist-Leninist perspective is to seek to form an absolute hegemony over all politics, right? But, you know, the other side of it is, what do you do if the anarchist movement is small, or at least so small that it cannot wage the struggle by itself? Because, as I said before, I don't think that there was, while I am very critical of the decisions of the CNT leadership, there was not an excellent choice. Because if they had refused to join the government, they wouldn't have gotten any weapons. If they had refused to work with any of the other left parties, they would have been isolated and sort of have had a civil war within a civil war. So, you know, there weren't excellent choices. In most political circumstances, there are not excellent choices. And when we're under attack from far right forces, it is important to try and seek out allies, and also in so doing, hopefully show some other tendencies that, you know, maybe anti-authoritarian forms of organization and resistance have some merits, and maybe you would want to change your mind. I think that the for me, the bottom line comes into sort of, on whose terms are anarchists working with other groups? So, you know, if in Barcelona, the anarchist movement had created a new kind of vessel of self-management that created space for other kinds of groups to participate, but on the terms set out by the CNT, or today, if anarchists form an anti-fascist coalition with other groups, are they doing it on terms that are horizontal, that don't replicate the kind of authoritarian structure that some other parties seek to use, and on whose terms are the actions being carried out? And, you know, in that way, I think there's room for coalition building or for joint ventures on anti-authoritarian horizontal terms, while, of course, remembering that if some of these authoritarian or Stalinist parties had their way, you know, we'd all have our backs up against the wall pretty quickly. So it's not an easy notion, but I think that those kinds of two considerations can be balanced uneasily in some circumstances.
So just last question to wrap it up, just in terms of looking back at the organizing that, and, you know, that's writ large, like all sorts of anarchist activity that were carried out in Spain that led up to the revolution. I mean, what kind of lessons there do you think that we can really take away? Like, what kind of, I mean, obviously we can't necessarily copy everything they did, but just in terms of activity and kind of like, you know, the strategy that people went about, or just even how they kind of looked at the situation in terms of what they wanted to build, what types of things can we really kind of glean from those decades that we should really be trying to emulate today?
Well, you know, one of the main reasons why anarchists reject hierarchical forms of organizing or resistance is because things ought to be, of course, directed by the people themselves. And in these contexts, there were so many forms of everyday resistance around the cost of food, rent, conscription for military service, labor grievances, child labor, you name it, that people were resisting whether or not the CNT was there or not. And a lot of the most kind of dynamic moments were sort of the CNT helping to push along or putting its name on something that was already going on or in the process of emerging. And it could do that because there were cultures of resistance that had developed over generations, where you didn't necessarily have to just be one type of person to get involved, that there was space for people who liked literature or drama or theater, people who were unionists, people who were interested in science, people who were interested in the arts. from different kinds of, you know, regional backgrounds and so forth. And so I guess my takeaway is we need to build cultures of resistance that are pluralistic, that have spaces for different kinds of people to contribute, that foster everyday resistance and create networks and bonds that allow us to support each other when these things come up. That having been said, though, that the circumstances are just wildly different, both in terms of the kind of economy and capitalist system that they were working within, the kind of state they were organizing against, the kind of means of political communication. There are a lot of differences, but I think that thinking through how we can build cultures of resistance and look for what's already going on and try to push it forward are some lessons to take away.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.